The golfer, photographed wearing an orange jumpsuit, now facing multiple charges, including second-degree assault of a police officer.
Israel's military says the body of a fourth hostage has now been recovered in Gaza. Those bodies recovered in the same operation inside tunnels. Israel says the bodies were likely taken to Hamas in Gaza after the October 7th attacks. Another round of storms moving across the Gulf and southeast today, packed with heavy rain and winds. This is ABC News. New troubles for music mogul Sean Diddy Combs. Newly released video obtained exclusively by CNN appears to show Combs assaulting then-girlfriend singer Cassie Ventura in an L.A. hotel in 2016. ABC's Melissa Adan has more.
Ventura's attorney responding to the video stating, "The gut-wrenching video has only further confirmed the disturbing and predatory behavior of Mr. Combs. Words cannot express the courage and fortitude that Ms. Ventura has shown in coming forward to bring this to light." Ventura's husband posting a letter on Instagram. He says he wrote a while back condemning domestic violence, writing in the caption, "I want my kids and every kid to live in a world that's safe for women and girls, protects them and treats them as equals."
Last November, Ventura filed a lawsuit claiming abuse. She and Combs settled. In Baltimore today, crowds gathering at Pimlico for the Preakness Stakes. Mystic Dan, the Kentucky Derby winner, is also racing. Michelle Franz and ABC News.
The Todd Almaz Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl, the Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're missing the obvious. Where's the Punch Bowl? Where's the Toilet Bowl? I think that there are other bowls that are being neglected.
I think it could maybe be the Snooper Bowl, though.
The Todd Almaz Show. Weekdays, noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
At Civic Media, we encourage active political engagement and remind listeners to think critically about political advertisements you may hear during this critical election year. Our stations are licensed by the FCC and are required to accept all ads for federal candidates. We also air state and local candidates as well as paid ads from issue and PAC groups. Truth is rarely as simple as any political ad may claim. So again, we urge you to think critically about what you hear in the spirit of promoting authentic and respectful civic dialogue.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m., on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
Come out of left field, like, hey, here's a great idea, let's do this. We've thought about this, and we have our municipalities aligned and on board.
Makra says EV Ready offers examples of forward-looking policies that make changes in codes to accommodate electric vehicles. The program began in 2022, and the first 12 municipalities completed it in late 2023.
The program provides resources and guidance and encouragement to municipalities to use their own unique strengths and authorities to advance EV adoption and an environment that's supportive for charging infrastructure.
The program, funded by the power utility ComEd, offers guidance on updating zoning and building codes, training first responders in dealing with EV fires, and accessing federal and state incentives. Local towns are required to post a website detailing resources for EV owners and aspiring owners.
Communicate to your residents about the incentives that are available through the state or the utility. Communicate to them about where and how to buy an EV, how to locate the EV charger, and then communicate about the participation in EV readiness.
I'm Mark Richardson. Find our 8 trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. It will be a little bit breezy out of the south. Showers and storms tonight, 59 are low. For Sunday, mostly cloudy and a high near 80. Sunday night, scattered showers and storms with a low of 58. Monday, storms and 78.
Right now, it's 82.
Where the fans own the team. This is the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
Hi, I'm Aaron, producer for the Todd Allbaugh Show here on Civic Media. You are about to hear an episode of Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, a podcast created by former Congressman Scott Klug. And Todd and I are helping work things out, too. This isn't the first episode, but don't worry, you haven't missed anything. We're just airing select episodes along with some bonus content afterwards from some of the interviews that didn't make the cut into the actual show. Enjoy.
Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans, is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance, safeguarding the dream of property ownership. Episode 3, Broken Hearts, Lessons from Third Party Runs for President, and a Bad High School Date.
Well, I guess we had a different idea of a great date. You know, this song clearly doesn't sync with my dating days, but you get the idea. Hell, everybody else is cashing in on Taylor Swift. We might as well do it, too. She wanted a quiet, romantic night together. But then I told my high school girlfriend we were headed to the crowded arena in downtown Milwaukee. She assumed it must have been a concert, right? Given the times, maybe Eric Clapton, The Doors, or the Strawberry Alarm Clock. Yeah, that really was a band, and they really did have one hit.
Ever since a couple man's meaningless bounds, turn on, tune in, turn your eyes around, look at your side.
Parking was hard to come by that night, and so were the tickets. It was a rally for independent candidate for president George Wallace. At that time, the Alabama governor was drawing huge crowds with speeches on overreach by the federal government, a tough-on-crime message, and picking fights with Vietnam protesters.
Well, I want to say this much. Let me say this much. Any of you anarchists in Georgia or California, wherever you happen to be, you better have your day now, because after November 5th, you are through in this country, I get it?
Now, let's be clear. Very clear in large capital letters. I was not a George Wallace supporter. I was just there to people watch. And he was polling above 20% at the time. The energy in the arena that night was pulsating. He rallied 7,000 loud supporters with a long list of grievances. In those early heady days of political campaigns, optimism flows like beer at a pregame tailgate party.
How about them Cowboys?
Yeah! Like teenage romance. It's all seashells and balloons. It was the first serious third-party candidacy since Teddy Roosevelt nearly six decades earlier. But in the end, third-party runs and high school crushes usually end in heartbreak. The Wallace campaign soon flamed out, and so did my date to the prom. It would be 25 years before Ross Perot launched the next serious challenge to the two major parties. And now, another three decades later, another independent run seems afoot, with 70% of the American public saying it has zero interest in a Trump-Biden rematch. I'm Scott Klug. I've been an Emmy Award-winning reporter, a four-term member of Congress, and a federal lobbyist. And like a huge swath of the American public, I'm lost in the middle. This 14-part podcast explains how we got into this mess, where the extremes now pass for the normal. And we're going to try to understand when politics turned into a blood sport and gleefully point the fingers at some of the people we think are to blame. And we'll offer up some green shoots of hope on how America can turn it all around.
How many of you wish that neither Trump nor Biden were running in 2024? And that both parties select a nominee from the next generation of candidates? Wow, I didn't even finish asking the question. And all five of you.
Oh, please.
Okay.
That's our friend Rich Thau asking voters in Georgia about the upcoming presidential race. He does focus groups around the country talking to swing voters.
I want you to imagine that in next year's election, you have three choices: Biden, Trump, and an independent moderate candidate who has the financial resources to run a competitive race. By a show of fingers, who'd seriously consider that third candidate? All five of you would.
What you hear in that focus group is what pollsters are hearing all across the country. There's a wind blowing across America, potentially at the back of an independent candidate. Nearly 50% of voters say they would strongly consider pulling that lever. But is that a howling wind of rage or just a tiny little summer breeze, people bored with Trump and Biden? Here's four names for you. You might want to write them down. Rocky De La Fuente, Don Blankenship, Brock Pierce, and Brian Carroll. So is this the starting infield for the New York Mets? Members of a rock band that your kids listen to that you've never heard of? Authors in the Oprah Book Club? Or four subjects of a Dateline murder mystery? Well, they're actually presidential candidates, and in some states, remember that phrase, some states, they were on the ballot in 2020. Respectively, the Alliance, the Constitution, the Independent, and the American Solidarity parties all averaged about 60,000 votes. And to keep this in perspective, in my last congressional campaign, I got 155,000 votes. But this year, it just might be different.
No labels, it's not nothing. They've got about nearly a $70 million operation going right now. They intend to be on the ballot in all 50 states. They have a convention in Dallas next April where they could announce that potential Republican-Democrat ticket. This is a big operation. This could be a real player if they, in fact, they do go forward with this plan. Listen to just a few of the New Hampshire voters here we met here today on the ground.
We need someone in the middle. You know, the issue is one extremist versus another extremist, and no one's ever going to agree if we just keep picking the extremes.
No, I need somebody else.
That is not Biden or Trump.
Right.
No Labels is a sophisticated bipartisan Washington political organization that's been around since 2011. Its claim to fame is the Problem Solvers Caucus, a coalition of Republicans and Democrats that helped pass the infrastructure bill. Its founder, Nancy Jacobson, was a longtime Democratic staffer and operative.
Wanted to finally try, if I could, to build with others, other leaders, a movement for the center. And I was, you know, so many people laughed at us and so many people dissuaded us and so many people said it could never, ever be done, that the center was not the place that had any passion or willingness to be part of a movement. But I stayed at it.
Now faced with a Trump-Biden rematch and sensing the bitter national mood, No Labels is flirting with a rumored Republican-Democrat unity ticket. Names kicked around in the press include Democratic Senator Joe Manchin, former Republican Governors Larry Hogan and John Huntsman, and current independent senator and one-time Democrat Kyrsten Sinema.
About 18 months ago, a bunch of leaders within our movement and also citizens across the country were, you know, starting to talk, and there was an observation that it could be a rematch race with Trump Biden. So that was 18 months ago with citizens, with our leaders, you know, so many conversations of people. And we just felt that we called it an insurance policy. We call it an insurance policy today because it's not definite that this happens.
Interestingly, younger voters are taking notice of a possible independent run. We talked to a group of recent college graduates in New England. Here's Lena.
I definitely feel like over the past 10 years, American politics have definitely gotten more extremely polarized. So there's like extremes on both ends. But I feel like, especially being portrayed in the media as well, we're not seeing as many moderate Democrats or moderate Republicans.
I think that the current state of the country is quite disappointing, and it's sad. Someone that has studied political science and someone that hopes to one day run for office, I think it's really, I would go as far as saying disgusting that we can't sit at a table and talk about things without being at each other's throat.
That's Alejandro. Before we get carried away, let's take a plunge into a cold bath of political reality. Remember all those obscure independent candidates we introduced you to just a couple of minutes ago? Most of them never made it to qualifying in 20 states, some far fewer. Want to launch a national campaign from ground zero like No Labels is talking about? Well, this was exactly the challenge handed to Teresa Amato, a young Chicago activist picked to run the Ralph Nader campaign in 2000.
I got a call asking if I would be interested in running his presidential campaign. And I explained that, you know, I hadn't run any, you know, campaigns in student council, much less a presidential one. And that I would, you know, be interested in trying.
First on her list, how in the hell to get on every state ballot?
The first thing and the most important thing is that a candidate for president of the United States, be it an independent or a third party candidate, has to get on the ballot in 50 states in the District of Columbia. So you have 51 different sets of rules, which means 51 different kinds of petitions, 51 sets of rules for the electors that would be voting for the candidate in the Electoral College. And it is a massive spreadsheet of details of everything from what time the petitions have to be turned in, when you can start, what color paper, what has to be on the face of the paper, whether you can call yourself an independent or you have to call yourself unaffiliated or not affiliated or whatever. The state legislatures, predominantly dominated by the two major parties, concoct to make it a complete hazing process for independents and minor parties to become ballot certified.
It's the reason so many of those obscure presidential candidates I introduced you to topped out in 20-ish states. In the four most populous states in the country, New York and California, Texas and Florida have the worst rules. Why would that be? Well, they're the two most important states for Democrats and the two most important for Republicans.
All the leaves are brown,
all the leaves are brown,
and the sky is gray.
In California, you need 196,000 valid signatures to get on the ballot. Texas, 113,000. If you belong to a major party, that's really not an issue. They've got party organizations in virtually every county in the country. But if you're no labels with 20,000 members nationally and likely just a scattering of people in a few states, it's a daunting task. And remember, those 196,000 signatures, the valid signatures in California, means you better collect a quarter of a million. And here's another person who had to learn all those crazy rules very quickly. Russ Verney was Ross Perot's campaign manager.
We challenged some state laws. I think they're all, for the most part, they're absolutely terrible. They're strictly designed to keep competition from the incumbents. They're written by the incumbents, so they're pretty effective.
And let's see if you can pull that off, right, and get in on all 50 states. Then you get on the stage in the presidential debate, right? Nope. The U.S. does not tolerate antitrust behavior in the economic system, but sadly it does in the political world. If Walmart and Amazon colluded, the Justice Department would sue to stop the monopoly. But in politics, it's boldly called the Presidential Debate Commission.
Many people think that the League of Women Voters still runs the presidential debates because once upon a time they did, and quite well for quite a while. But then the two parties, and it was led by the head of the Democratic Party and the head of the Republican Party, got together and created initially a bipartisan, then they realized they had to be nonpartisan commission on presidential debates. The commission says it has objective rules for who gets to participate. And in the two elections I ran in 2000 and 2004 for Ralph Nader, those rules consisted of you had to have 15% of ratings in five different polls that they determined. Getting on the commission on the Commission on Presidential Debates stage is what allows people to get to 15% because then the public can hear you.
And next year is going to be even more complicated. After the contentious 2020 debates, no one knows who's running the debates in 2024. So let's say, for the sake of an argument, No Labels gets on all 50 ballots. It's only on 10 as I write this. But now for a reality check. Only three times in American history has an independent candidate gathered enough momentum to be a credible presidential candidate. To be successful, a winning candidate needs charisma, organization, and be riding the crest of a wave.
This podcast is brought to you by the American Property Owners Alliance. Our country recognizes home ownership as one of the best ways to build wealth and stable communities. But over the years, support for home ownership has dwindled, and our leaders have lost sight of its value. We're working to change that. The American Property Owners Alliance is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that holds our leaders accountable to safeguard homeowners and communities. Visit PropertyOwnersAlliance.org to learn more and find out how you can join our efforts.
Enter Teddy Roosevelt, arguably the most charismatic president in U.S. history, who came to office when President McKinley was assassinated. American University professor Alan Lichtman.
He was a maverick Republican, as we know, a reformer, a progressive. Republican establishment hated him when he was governor of New York. So Boss Platt of New York said, let's put him in the most useless position possible. We'll make him William McKinley's vice president. And Mark Hanna, McKinley's campaign manager, warned, do you want that crazy cowboy one heartbeat from the presidency? Nobody listened. He became vice president, and then the cowboy became president.
After completing McKinley's term, he handily won re-election with 57%. You know, he captured the American imagination with the sheer force of his personality. He'd been a war hero with the Rough Riders in the Spanish-American War. He loved the West and created the National Park System. The son of an affluent banker in Manhattan, he bucked his own social class, filing antitrust cases against the New York power brokers, many of whom he'd grown up with. He easily could have won again. Remember, there was no two-term rule at this time. Instead, he walked away and handed the White House to William Howard Taft, his hand-picked successor. But after a two-year African trip, followed by a speech swing through Europe and writing a series of books, he came back bored, energized, and frustrated with Taft. In the end, he lost his battle with Republicans to regain the nomination. Party leaders picked Taft in June of 1910. Roosevelt stormed out of the convention, his delegates right behind him. Two months later in Chicago, the National Bull Moose Party, as it came to be called, rallied around Roosevelt. It was the first time in U.S. history a candidate came to a convention to give a speech, and it was a stem winder, Professor David Zarefsky.
His appearance set off a 58-minute-long demonstration of support and enthusiasm before he ever began to speak. He spoke for 2 hours. He was stopped for applause 145 times during the speech, the biggest applause line being when he came out in the speech in favor of woman suffrage.
You know, truth be told, I've been a Teddy Roosevelt fan my whole life. When I left Congress, term limit guy that I was, I rewarded myself for keeping my word by buying a letter that Roosevelt wrote to Mr. W.R. Kissin of New York. It was written in 1918, in the waning days of World War I. Here's what it reads. You know, that's a mighty nice letter you wrote, starts Teddy. Will you give my heartfelt thanks to your three gallant boys? You know, you and I have the same reason to feel so proud. All of Teddy Roosevelt's sons fought in World War I, and Quentin, who was a pilot, was killed in action. With three boys of my own, that letter still hangs in my home office. It's framed with a picture of Teddy Roosevelt walking out of the Milwaukee train station in February of 1912 on his way to a major campaign event. Not long after that picture was taken, he was shot. But his eyeglass case and a thick speech tucked in his coat saved his life. Undaunted, Roosevelt rushed to deliver a speech, and with the memorable line that it takes more than one bullet to kill a bull moose. But even that bravado, coupled with his legendary exploits, was not enough to carry him across the finish line. Roosevelt won a mere 6 states and 88 electoral votes. Taft won only 2. Wilson, with 47% of the vote, won 40 states and ended the most successful independent run in U.S. history.
From CBS Washington, In Color, Face the Nation, a spontaneous and unrehearsed news interview with George Wallace, former governor of Alabama and presidential candidate of the American Independent Party.
Governor, despite your own optimism about your chances, every poll, every indicator of national opinion shows that you yourself have no hope to win to the presidency. Your critics contend, therefore, that you're deliberately adopting the role of spoiler, that is, trying to throw the election into the House of Representatives. How would you answer that analysis?
Well, at least, Mr. Agronsky, we have critics, and they're paying attention to our movement. As you've noticed in the papers in the last number of days, members of both parties have said we must join together to stop this movement headed by George Wallace. Of course, George Wallace is one individual, but I am speaking for many millions of people in our country. I might say that there are many polls that I win. I have won on television and radio.
That's Alabama Governor George Wallace on his surging 1968 campaign. The clip you're about to hear is not actually from my Wisconsin date from Hill, but it'll give you a flavor of the times. The protests against the Vietnam War were peaking. After Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, riots erupted in major cities around the country. And busing to desegregate schools was a flashpoint in the nation's suburbs. Protesters in a packed hall tried to shout Wallace down.
And when he was in California, a group of anarchists lay down in front of his automobile and threatened his personal safety, the President of the United States. Well, I want to tell you, if you'll elect me the president, and I go to California, or I come to Arkansas, and some of them lie down in front of my automobile, it'll be the last one they'll ever want to lie down.
Here's Wallace historian Dan Carter.
He had a sense of what crowds, when he spoke to them, he had a sense of how they responded. And he saw there was a great deal of dissatisfaction.
George Wallace had first made a name for himself by fighting federal court orders to desegregate Alabama schools. But busing had become a major hot point in many northern cities. And the crowd he got that night in Milwaukee was typical.
Governor Wallace, is your real ambition to win the presidency, or is it to get enough votes to dictate who does go to the White House?
My real purpose in running for the presidency is to win, and to win outright on November 5th. And I think if you'll follow me around in the country and see the reception we're getting from one end of the country to the other, you can see that we have an excellent chance of winning the election on November 5th at the polls.
By now, the rules of the game had changed since the days of Teddy Roosevelt. A third-party candidate had to personally get on the ballot in all 50 states. One by one, tough, hand-to-hand combat. And Wallace did it with a strong network of local volunteers and a fundraising operation that was groundbreaking for its time.
One of the great achievements of Wallace was to get on the ballot in 50 states. You know, that was really almost unheard of, given the ballot restrictions in various states. California was a perfect example. They had to get 150,000 signatures. Can you imagine? For George Wallace in California, they got 200,000.
In the clip from CBS Face the Nation we used to kick off the segment, Wallace bragged about his ability to win the White House. But the truth is, internally, his campaign had already pivoted, hoping to win enough votes to deadlock the Electoral College and play Republicans and Democrats off one another. Alan Lichtman again.
Wallace was smart. He knew he couldn't win, but what he had hoped to do was win enough states to deadlock the Electoral College, keep either Humphrey the Democrat or Nixon the Republican from winning an Electoral College majority. And then it would go to the House with each state having one vote, and Wallace would be the kingmaker controlling the swing Southern states. Didn't quite work out, but it was close.
Wallace was the last independent candidate to win states, five, all in the Deep South. But he came very close in North and South Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. In 1972, he ran again, but this time in the Democratic primaries, and won three early states. But in February, George Wallace was shot at a rally in a Maryland suburb. Now paralyzed, he dropped out of the presidential race, but he did stay active in Alabama politics for another 20 years.
No,
number one, I will not run as either a Democrat or Republican because I will not sell out to anybody but to the American people.
Wow. It's hard to forget that voice. That's Ross Perot on CNN in February of 1992. The wealthy Dallas businessman with ears as big as his home state of Texas had flirted with running for president for months. He was a fierce critic of George Bush and Bill Clinton and a zealot deficit hawk. Perot had been giving speeches around the country on the need to balance the budget, and there was a groundswell of support. Some Americans responded by urging him to run for president, and he turned around with his own challenge.
If you're that serious, you, the people, are that serious, you register me in 50 states. And if you're not willing to organize and do that, then this is all just talk.
Stay with me, Larry.
I'm saying to the ordinary folks, and I don't want any machine.
This is a draft, Ross Perot.
No. I'm not asking to be drafted. Okay. I'm saying to all these nice people that have written me and the letters, you know, filled cases. Now, if you're dead serious,
start committees.
I want to see
Georgia.
Some sweat.
Astoundingly, it actually happened.
To be honest with you, the thing that most attracted me to that entire campaign was when I sat down with staff and volunteers and learned that unlike at a Republican or a Democratic meeting, nobody was there to get something.
Russ Ferney was a longtime New Hampshire Democratic campaign veteran who signed on with Perot.
They were all there to give something. You go to a Democratic Party meeting and somebody wants a contract, somebody wants an appointment, somebody wants an endorsement, somebody wants a donation. Same with Republican meetings. You go to a Perot meeting, he had nothing to give anybody. It was all about what can we do to make our country better? How can I serve?
Perot's campaign relied on half-hour TV programs that he personally paid for himself. Whatever is the opposite of slick, that's what it was. Perot was on camera with homemade charts, he actually made them, that looked like they were stolen from an eighth grade government class. But they got the point across. Here he is lambasting Bill Clinton's claim of an Arkansas economic miracle.
Let's come down to brass tacks now. On the economy, they rank last among the 50 states in median family income. Now, there's no place to go but up. That's the good news. On economy, Arkansas ranks last, it's 50th among the 50th states, in the hourly wages for manufacturing workers. Not much manufacturing work in Arkansas. Manufacturing wages are the high-paying wages, the jobs of the future.
The race quickly gained momentum, and Perot was the last independent candidate to make the cut for the presidential debate, where his folksy delivery put both George Bush Sr. and Bill Clinton right back on their heels.
The dollar's gone through the floor. Now, whose fault is that? Not the Democrats, not the Republicans. Somewhere out there, there's an extraterrestrial that's doing this to us, I guess. And everybody says they take responsibility. Somebody somewhere has to take responsibility for this. Now, just for the record, I don't have any spin doctors. I don't have any speech writers. Probably shows. I make those charts you see on television even. That shows.
But the truth be told, in the end, Perot did have campaign consultants, but he wanted to win without getting his hands dirty. And he shockingly bowed out of the race in the summer, only to reemerge in the fall. But by then, both Bush and Clinton had relentlessly hammered away at the theme that a third-party candidate could never win. It was a wasted vote. Perot finished with 19%, but really didn't come close to winning a single state.
Well, you go back to the debates and you can see it. Both Bush and Clinton would constantly say, I agree with Mr. Perot, but he can't win. So no. Vote for me. I'm closer. It's a wasted vote if you vote for the third party. And that truly had an effect on the outcome of the election.
So let's pick up the no labels thread again. I think we pointed out that history suggests it faces the longest of long shots. Nobody's ever really come close to a successful run, even with a popular candidate, a sophisticated organization, or tapping into a swelling populist sentiment in the country. But someone does think it will be a serious threat in the 2024 elections. Democrats. Democrats are worried that no labels will cost Joe Biden the election. Here's an old friend, former Majority Leader Dick Gephardt.
they assert two things from their polling that Mark Penn has done. Their first assumption is that they can get 270 votes, electoral votes, for a no labels candidate. So that's the first thing you have to test. And then they secondly say that if they don't get 270 votes, that they will take votes equally away from Trump and Biden. We tested all of that by a reputable pollster, and it shows exactly the opposite. They cannot get 270 votes, and it will take more votes from Biden than Trump. In fact, it confirms that it would elect Trump. Now, there are at least eight other polls that were done contemporaneously by other pollsters that show the same thing.
You know, as we've told you, the spoiler label has been used in the past to bludgeon independent candidates. Until his death, George H. Bush continued to blame Ross Perot for his election loss. Well, maybe. Here's the take of the political website 538 on the controversy. First, it's reporter John Kornacki, Bush strategist Mary Matlin, and her husband, Democratic strategist James Carville.
There is a myth out there that if you look back at 1992, well, Bill Clinton is only president because Ross Perot ran.
Ross Perot absolutely cost George H.W. Bush re-election in 92.
There is no evidence in political science that supports the fact that he cost anyone the election.
Here's Perot campaign manager Russ Verney one more time.
With respect to Perot, that's the Republican wine, and they need a wheel of cheese to go with it. There's no truth in it whatsoever. In fact, the polling from Voter Research Services that came out on exit polling was very clear that the results of the election would have been exactly the same had Perot not been in the race.
And then in 2000, it was the Democrats' turn. They pointed the finger at Ralph Nader for costing them a win in Florida, which handed George W. Bush the White House.
You know, in Florida, there were 10 presidential candidates on the ballot. In addition, Mr. Bush and Mr. Gore both had, they were two of the 10. All other eight candidates got more than 537 votes, the amount of votes that separated Gore and Bush in the end.
You know, she's dead right. You could put the blame on any number of parties that got more than 537 votes in Florida that year. For example, the Natural Law Party got 2,300, the Workers' World Party 1,800, and the Constitution Party 1,300.
Everybody was more than 537. Are you saying that nobody can ever run except for the two major candidates? And what I don't like in the question is the implicit assumption that one of the two major parties deserves or owns those votes. And it's always about a horse race and not about what kinds of ideas are we putting forward.
In the months ahead, No Labels not only faces external challenges, ballot access, and the presidential debate, but internally it has to figure out how it's even going to pick a candidate. Or if Biden or Trump bows out, does the ticket ever really happen?
Look, every 4 years you have the American people say, oh my God, we don't love what we have. We'd like something different. You know, the grass is always greener, right, on the other side. But when you're confronted with real choices and the fact that third-party campaigns can't win, there really is no chance. You know, Joe Manchin running on No Labels, you know, my head is going to hit my desk here. You know, Cornel West, too obscure. Kennedy Jr., a nut. You know, there isn't a Ross Perot or a Teddy Roosevelt or a George Wallace out there.
In 2016, reporters and friends laughed at me when I said, watch out for Donald Trump. And believe me, I did not say that as a supporter. But if you live in the Midwest like I do, you could sort of feel it bubbling up. Right now, 70% of voters say they dread a Trump-Biden rematch. Good place to start if you're No Labels and an independent candidate. Next year, in a strange nod to history, the Democratic Convention will be back in Chicago, where they locked out George Wallace in 1968, and the Republicans in Milwaukee, where Teddy Roosevelt was shot. Not a lot of great karma for independent candidates. Hey, but if nothing else, politics in the U.S. is always unpredictable. You know, there's one great third-party success story. When some country lawyer got nominated for president in 1860, it was to run at the top of the ticket for a breakaway third party. Abraham Lincoln's Republican Party demolished the Whigs, which had been around for 40 years. If you're a fan of our podcast, you know we really don't try to make this a current news show. But in the No Labels case, we're going to have to make an exception. There'll be significant developments to come in the months ahead, a go-no-go decision, and deciding even on a ticket. As they say in old-fashioned radio, stay tuned. More to come. Here's the team behind Lost in the Middle. Executive producer Jeff Mayers. Producer Todd Elbaugh. Creative team Claudia Luz and Tony Wood. Edited by Aaron Zummers. Music by Brett William. Production at Civic Media. And a quick thanks to our partners at the American Property Owners Alliance.
From I-43 to I-41. This is the Talk of Green Bay. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Scottie Scheffler back on the course for today's PGA Championship in Louisville, but the number one golfer in the world is also facing multiple charges after driving around a roadblock and injuring an officer yesterday. ABC's Trevor Ault is in Louisville.
Scheffler's attorney says a police officer told him to drive around a line of cars waiting to enter. The police report says Scheffler refused to stop, accelerating forward and dragging that officer, who suffered pain, swelling, and abrasions to his left wrist and knee. The golfer, photographed wearing an orange jumpsuit, now facing multiple charges, including second-degree assault of a police officer.
Israel's military says the body of a fourth hostage has now been recovered in Gaza. Those bodies recovered in the same operation inside tunnels. Israel says the bodies were likely taken to Hamas in Gaza after the October 7th attacks. Another round of storms moving across the Gulf and Southeast today, packed with heavy rain and winds. This is ABC News.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
Josh Hader gets the save. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers losing game one of their series in Houston. The crew had the lead but let it slip away in the fifth. Freddy Peralta giving up a three-run home run. Top of the ninth, Josh Hader in the game, retiring his old team. The Brewers 1-2-3 as the Astros won 5-4 at Minute Maid Park. That's Hader's sixth save of the season. He now has recorded a save against all 30 major league teams. Sam Frelick went 1-3. Despite the loss, Frelick says the Brewers clubhouse is getting along fine right now.
Love everybody in this clubhouse. I think we all mesh really well together. Pitchers, position players, everybody, staff. So, yeah, when you get rolling like that and a game and in a week and stuff like that, it is contagious. Everyone feels good going into the next day, so just hopefully keep that going forward.
NFL Packers receiver Romeo Doubs had a fundraiser with Gilbert Brown in Milwaukee last night, helping children with spinal injuries. The Packers OTAs are next week in Green Bay. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunshine and highs in the mid-80s. It will be a little bit breezy out of the south. Showers and storms tonight, 59 are low. For Sunday, mostly cloudy and a high near 80. Sunday night, scattered showers and storms with a low of 58. Monday, storms and 78.
Right now, it's 82.
The road construction season is underway, and you've probably noticed orange cones and barrels are back too. The world's leading manufacturer of these safety products is Lakeside Plastics. The family-owned business is based in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. Do you know why the cones were originally created more than 75 years ago? As a safety marker to keep drivers away from newly painted lines on the road, as an object for drivers to weave around to mark the tops of houses for small airplane pilots. The answer's coming up.
Message.
From the home of the frozen tundra, Green Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Lost in the Middle, America's Political Orphans on Civic Media. Here's some bonus content that didn't make it into the episode with Todd Elbaugh and Scott Klug.
Todd here along with Scott Klug. And Scott, we try to keep these things evergreen, as we say in the business. They can run any time, but you have some timely news on independence. We're going to hear from Teresa Amato in just a minute, but set it up for us.
Well, so when we first ran this episode in October, there was a sense of a lot of move towards independence. Independent voters now are surging across the country, but the candidates themselves who are trying to get off the ground aren't getting off the ground. So in Robert Kennedy's case, he's having so much trouble with ballot access, he may now actually run as a Libertarian. That's assuming the Libertarians would pick him at their convention, which is probably a coin toss. And then meanwhile, No Labels, who's a big part of this story, is also falling apart. Larry Hogan, who is a board member, sometimes rumored vice presidential candidate on a bipartisan ticket, just walked away from it. I think what you're starting to see with No Labels is what a lot of people say about independence. They're independents until they all get in a room together and you're pro-choice and I'm pro-life and you're for the border and I'm not for the border. And it turns into fistfights and nothing gets done. And so I think in this case, though, we could still see one of them serving in some states as a spoiler. And in fact, now we're going to hear from Teresa Amato, who actually, she and Ralph Nader get the blame for losing Florida for Al Gore, which then made George W. Bush the president. Although I will point out to my Democratic listeners, had he won his own state of Tennessee, he would have been elected president, says the snarky Republican. But if you look at Florida, there were actually a number of minor parties, including a Nader's candidacy, that all got enough votes to put Florida into play and make it the mess that it was.
Here's Teresa and Scott. We're back on the other side.
I had met Ralph in the early 90s, and I then started a nonprofit organization in Chicagoland, out in where I grew up in DuPage County. And I guess I meandered from Cook County to DuPage County. I could see both strong Republican and strong Democratic forces in both counties, right? Almost uniparty in both situations. And I got a call asking if I would be interested in running his presidential campaign. And I explained that, you know, I hadn't run any campaigns in student council, and much less a presidential one. And that I would, you know, be interested in trying, but that, you know, I was assured this is going to be a different kind of campaign. It's going to be a campaign that runs with the people. I pretty much assumed it was going to be the poor kind of campaign. We would not have very many resources, but I was game. And I got on a plane and went to Washington, reading the Code of Federal Regulations on my way, what to do in terms of campaign finance laws, and figuring out that it wasn't really written for independents and third parties, the federal code. And so there were many areas of ambiguities, and thinking that on arrival, there were about three people, less than $40,000 in the budget because a website had been thrown up, 400 messages in the ether on a voicemail asking, are you really running? And we started pretty much from scratch to build a very grassroots organization to run for president of the United States, which revealed all kinds of lessons on how difficult it is, even if you are a national icon. And, you know, in many ways, Ralph has always been on these lists of the 100 most influential leaders in the United States and Americans of all time. Even someone with that kind of background would have a very difficult time as a person not running with either of the two major parties.
So what were the first obstacles you saw?
The first thing and the most important thing is that a candidate for president of the United States has to get on the ballot in 50 states and the District of Columbia. So you have 51 different sets of rules, which means 51 different kinds of petitions. And it is a massive spreadsheet of details of everything from what time the petitions have to be turned in, when you can start, what color paper, what has to be on the face of the paper, whether you can call yourself an independent or you have to call yourself unaffiliated or not affiliated or whatever. The state legislatures, predominantly dominated by the two major parties, concoct to make it a complete hazing process for independents and minor parties to become ballot certified. And if you're not on the ballot, it's very difficult to have anybody vote for you. And so you're really looking at an amalgamation of rules that each one can be daunting. Some are quite, you know, reasonable and easy to pass muster. but many of them are quite difficult. And it's further complicated by the fact that you have the partisan administration of these election systems in most states. You know, your Secretary of State or your Attorney General or the State Board of Elections have various people in charge. Oftentimes, they are the banner carrier of one of the presidential candidates in that state, and yet they're still running the election machinery and the election process, and therefore have quite a bit of influence about how the process, how the ballot access process works, and what's counted as a signature on a petition, what's not counted as a signature, and sometimes those issues go to court as well.
So is there a state or an anecdote that comes to mind?
Well, there are so many. In fact, there were so many, I wrote a book, as you know, because it was unfathomable to me. Here I was, you know, government and economics major, a lawyer, and I couldn't even believe how difficult we made it in the United States to run for president of the United States. You know, we all grew up with the American dream that anyone can be president of the United States and that we're, you know, the best democracy or democratic republic, if you want to be technical, you know, in the world, and that we have so many lessons to share about democracy abroad. And yet sometimes we make it incredibly undemocratic in the small d sense, right, for anybody to participate in the electoral arena. We tolerate things in the electoral arena we would never tolerate in the economic arena. And everybody knows if you don't have competition, you have a system that's subject to stagnation, paralysis, corruption, all kinds of things when there's no possible new entries into the discourse. And it's so important for our presidential campaigns to have regeneration, rejuvenation, new ideas put into the national discourse, which we've seen historically in the United States, right? From abolition to women's suffrage to portions of the New Deal, et cetera, labor laws, you know. And without having that, you don't get percolation of, you know, ideas, which some may be easily dismissed, but some, you know, become commonplace 10, 20, 30 years later. But if nobody is able to raise those new ideas, or you cut off everybody from the get-go saying, well, you're the fringe, or you don't have a place at the table, or you're cluttering the playing field, what are you doing? You're preventing the American people from exploring different topics, different positions, and that's just undemocratic.
But is there a state? And was it one day where you guys said, oh, California, Florida, whatever it was, what drove you crazy?
It's really impossible to narrow it down to one or two or three because I wrote about so many of them because everything can trip up a candidate. And I should point out that, you know, for somebody facing this for the first time, having to get on the ballot, any person who is entering as an independent or a minor party candidate who doesn't have an in-house cottage industry like both of the major parties do, that they're set up to run nonstop, you know, from the day one election starts to the day it ends to the next day it starts again. And you are lacking in the resources to hire expertise, to hire vendors that can help your campaign go. In terms of ballot access, we had to create our own internal treatise on electors and ballot access, with, of course, some outside questions to people who had done this before and or knew the laws quite well. The problem is the laws can change or how they are applied, even in the middle of an election. If a Secretary of State sends around a hello everyone memo, this is how we're going to treat counting laws this year. You can have as much preparation as possible and still get tripped up. Also because the administrators of the election don't want to say because they don't want you to rely on them for any kind of advice. So either they say they don't know, they can't say anything, and you have to figure it out. Even small states can make it quite difficult, like West Virginia, for example. You had to stop by and you had to get solicitor credentials and you had to display them. And there was a whole question about whether or not you had displayed them. And our petitioners, in the meantime, were meeting people, facing people, apparently, I was told, you know, with shotguns, just to stand on the corner. Because when you think about this process, it's Byzantine. It's so unsuited to the 21st century, where you can do anything online or with, you go to an ATM, you expect $20 to come out of the ATM when you punch in $20, right? However, here the process is, it's a hazing process. That's what I want to say.
That was Teresa Model along with Scott. Thanks for listening.
And we'll see you again next time on Lost in the Middle.
Mino and the Mayor in the Morning, and the talk of Green Bay all day long. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Todd Almaz Show.
Trumpster asked the judge and said, hey, can I not come to court because I want to go to my son's graduation? So here now, from the Raw story, Trump plans Minnesota fundraiser on the day of Barron's graduation. When I graduated, you have a get-together with family and friends. It's kind of a day. A parent shouldn't just be ducking in and out.
You have to be a parent for that. And he is a parent in name only. A pino.
The Todd Almaz Show. Weekdays, noon till 2. On your local Civic Media radio station. And on the app.
My mom has taken up going to the park to practice yoga.
My dad's going to a club, but not a book club, a salsa club.
Finding new hobbies comes with age.
My mom has started getting lost and not knowing where she's going.
Becoming lost or disoriented doesn't. Confusion with time or place may be a sign of Alzheimer's. An early diagnosis can help improve the quality of life for your loved one. Learn the warning signs of Alzheimer's at 10signs.org. Brought to you by the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
Matt Mayer on air.
Dr. Karen Tamarius, she's a political psychiatrist, and we're talking about how to talk to people with which we do not agree.
Think of the mind as a rider on an elephant. The conscious part is the rider, and the emotional part is the elephant. If you want the person to change their mind, you need to talk with the elephant, not the rider.
Matt Mayer on air, weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Benny Gantz, top rival of Israel's prime minister, calling for decisive operations in Rafah and calling on Benjamin Netanyahu to approve a post-war plan by June 8th, or Gantz says he'll resign from the war cabinet. Gantz says Hamas cannot remain in Rafah if there is to be peace between Israel and Palestinians, and says protecting civilians is important.
So yes, we understand the needed condition. We understand that there are civilians that we need to move from once in a while to other places to protect them from the fight itself. And we are doing it, and many of them and most of them have actually evacuated to different places.
In Tel Aviv, Israelis are out protesting again for weekly demonstrations, demanding the prime minister bring home the remaining hostages. Israel's military says it's recovered 4 bodies of hostages in Gaza. On the campaign trail, President Biden in Atlanta. Tomorrow, he'll deliver the commencement speech at Morehouse College. Donald Trump in Texas to speak at the annual NRA conference. This is ABC News. Auto workers in Alabama rejected a push to unionize at Mercedes-Benz plants.
56% of Mercedes-Benz factory workers have voted against joining the United Auto Workers.
Obviously not the result we wanted.
UAW President Sean Fain says his organization plans to continue the effort.
This law stings. While this law stings, I'll tell you this, you know, we're going to keep our heads up, keep our heads held high. These workers have nothing to do but be proud of the effort they put forth and what they've done.
The Mercedes vote comes a month after the UAW scored a win at a Volkswagen assembly plant in Tennessee. Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
A day after top golfer Scottie Scheffler was arrested while on his way to the PGA Championship in Louisville for driving around a roadblock, Scheffler's attorney says an officer told him to proceed. But the police report says Scheffler refused to stop and dragged the officer, briefly injuring him. Scheffler's facing multiple charges, including second-degree assault of a police officer. Michelle Franzen, ABC News.
The Todd Alba Show.
The fantastic Jane Matt Nair of Matt Nair on Air. I'm a big fan of like the Rose Bowl, the Orange Bowl, the Cotton Bowl. Well, now from Snoop Dogg, they're going to have the Snoop Bowl. The Snoop Bowl. How about that, Jane?
I think we're